You're about to hear my conversation with our chief fixed income strategist, Dustin Reed. We talk all about the Bank of Canada, Bank of Japan, and of course, get his reaction to the Fed meeting. I hope you enjoy. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Information relating to investment approaches or individual investments should not be construed as advice or endorsement. Listeners should seek professional advice for their situation. Welcome to the Market Exchange, a podcast from Mackenzie Investments. I'm your host, Matt Schnurr, and I'm back with my regular guest, Dustin Reed. Dustin, welcome back.
Hey, Matt. Thanks very much for having me back on the show.
As your role as the chief fixed income strategist, that takes you to different places for meetings and all the like. I hear that last week you were in New York, the week of the 11th, the week before the Fed meeting. I'm curious, what did you learn during your tour?
Yeah, I was. A lot of interesting things for sure. Spent a number of days in the city seeing a lot of counterparties who are obviously very, very important to our investment process, not only for fixed income team, but just general macro as it relates to, the firm. I think there were a few takeaways. So this was, I was there for when the CPI, US CPI got released and PPI right. data got released, both the Tuesday and the Thursday. Those were a little bit hotter than expected, and kind of the understanding the makeup of that and how some of the floors and strategy folks, macro folks and traders were interpreting the data and what it might mean for, the Fed meeting. One thing that definitely came up was, when CPI printed on the Tuesday and core CPI in particular, 36 basis points, and that's obviously the February data. People were comparing that obviously to the January data, right? So recall that people were saying, okay, and it printed 39 basis points for January core CPI. Is it right. seasonal? Is it the seasonal adjustment factor, which are related things, but separate things, I think. What's going on here? And, a few people noticed, and I did too, and I went through the data after the fact, that even though they were relatively close, 39 and 36 basis points, respectively, January and February, the makeup, the building block, so to speak, of how it got there for each month, respectively, were almost, not quite, but almost a mirror image of each other. Hmm. And that kind of brought into the, the idea, the thought that, was January, how seasonal or what was the seasonal impact or the seasonality of January if the building blocks of February were almost entirely different, but you ended up with a net 0.03 or 3 basis points difference between the January and the February core CPI numbers. So that was a big part of the discussions Tuesday afternoon, Wednesday, frankly, for the whole week, and kind of, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, is it seasonal, is it not? Should we look at January and February as seasonal or just kind of early year where inflation, typically inflation's a little bit hotter in the first half and the second half, just the way things work. And that makes sense when you think of price increases, not always, but generally a lot of it gets skewed to the very early part of the year, January, right? Like new year, raise your prices, that sort of sure. thing. So when you think about it that way, it's like, okay, yeah, well, obviously, maybe H1 does kind of on the margin, all other things being equal, kind of if it's in totality, it's higher than the second half of the year. So anyway, just kind of debating that. And obviously the important part, well, two links. I mean, how does the Fed think about it? And then obviously what is the market? What would the market do kind of beyond that? The other big thing I picked up, and this is really interesting, I think, for our listeners here, particularly sitting domestically in Canada, we're very used to the immigration story in Canada and what it's doing to maybe the housing market, what it might be doing to wages, the labor market, inflation, all those things. That debate has not really been as significant. It's clearly not moved along in the U.S. as it has here domestically in Canada. But what I picked up in New York was a number of people, not everybody, but a number of people were talking about how the immigration story in the U.S. is affecting the economy, in particular the labor market, supply of labor, so to speak. And I think that's important if and when we talk about the Fed in this conversation. But the supply of labor, the impact on wages, what might be getting counted, what might not,
right.
How is it showing up in the establishment survey, which is the headline non-farm payrolls number, i.e. like 250,000 jobs or whatever the number is, versus the household survey, which is the unemployment rate. Those are actually two different surveys. And how is that being calculated? What's being reflected and what's being not? You know, is the Fed aware of this? Which they usually are, and those sorts of things, and kind of figuring out. So this kind of nitty gritty, really detailed stuff around the economics and what's the building blocks and understanding the Fed's reaction function, where people are positioned, you know, where a lot of the hedge fund community is, like, you know, real money that obviously maybe are a little bit more tactical like us in terms of kind of trading in and out as opposed to just sit and hold and, you know, do two trades a year type thing. So I thought that was very interesting. So anyway, I got a lot out of the trip, and I used to go a lot before the pandemic, and I used to work in New York for a long time. And anyway, I find the conversations really, really interesting. Yeah, so a lot of takeaways there, and it definitely helped me set up for the Fed this week.
Well, I'll bite, Dustin. So I had the Fed yesterday at the very simplistic level. Nothing seems like it's changed, at least for this year. The dots are the same. The rates are stable. What do you take away from the Fed?
I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I would say yes and no. And there's, you know, especially because it's a forecast round, there's always a little bit more to kind of take away than the non-forecast round. So March meeting for the Fed, FOMC is obviously a forecast round, which is what we got. So the new dots, et cetera, et cetera. The statement itself, which is obviously the big thing, at least the most formal thing, was hardly changed whatsoever. I mean, there was one small change in the opening paragraph, which really didn't. I didn't think it was a big takeaway. So really the statement was almost a carbon copy. The dots, as you say, were very focused on. I spent a lot of time on the previous week when I was traveling speaking about those as well. And there was not a huge amount of consensus whether the 24 dot would change or not. Recall that in December, I guess, the Fed had penciled in 75 basis points worth of easing right. for 2024. And the majority was by two votes on a denominator of 19. So pretty close. Mm-hmm. We thought it was going to be close. It did not move, but that denominator of 19, that majority, I should say, is now one. So it's, you know, it was 11-8 before, I guess. Now it's 10-9. So it's exceptionally close. But the Fed did raise its estimate for 25 and 26 and the long run dot. And so right. when I say raise, it basically took out a 25 basis point cut for 2025, 2026, and it raised the long term dot ever so slightly, which is kind of the forevermore, where is neutral, so to speak, but it was ever so slightly marked higher. Now, kind of in coordination with that, what I think is really, really interesting is the Fed increased its 2024 core PCE estimates by 0.2, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is, from 2.4 to 2.6. And probably a little bit more than most people would have expected. Some people, I think a lot of people were nothing, stay the same. A lot of people were also maybe one tick higher from 2.4 to 2.5. It went to 2.6. And then the growth estimate for this year, partially because growth has been absolutely, you know, ripping in the U.S. back part of last year. So you have a pretty good handoff, as we say, from the end of 23 into 24. And so just from an accounting perspective, you get a pretty good running start. And Q1's moving along at a good pace. We don't have the official numbers for Q1. Obviously, we won't get them till around mid-April out of the U.S. The Q1 number was revised quite a bit higher from 1.4 to 2.1%. And that is significant. So again, you've got inflation, particularly core PCE, revised higher, maybe a little bit more so than expected. You've got a real GDP for 24 also getting revised pretty significantly higher. But going back to where I was a minute ago, they did not think that there needed to be less cuts for 2024. Admittedly, it's still exceptionally close, but it didn't move. And I think that is particularly interesting because I think Powell, what I said to the crew here kind of in the immediate aftermath is I think Powell is winning the debate internally now, in terms of, you know, we can have inflation a little bit higher. And that's pretty significant, right? You've got inflation now expected to be 2.6% on core PCE by the end of the year. And they still are going to do, well, in theory, they're saying that they'll do 75 basis points worth of easing. And that hasn't changed from 3 months ago. And we expect growth to be significantly stronger. And to be fair, this is not 4% growth, right? This is not massive growth. I mean, you're still kind of in the soft landing neighborhood, but sure, maybe from the low soft landing neighborhood of 1.4 to kind of the mid plus soft landing neighborhood, at least how I would quantify it, at 2.1. So these things can come higher, but we're still going to do this, or we're planning to do it. We'll see what they do. We won't know until December 31st of this year, but we're still planning to do the same amount of easing. And that suggests to me that Powell's ideas, and I think they are, Powell is quite dovish here, are winning. He's winning the debate inside. Recall the December FOMC meeting, the press conference, I'm sure many people remember, was extremely dovish. You know, equity, you know, risk assets performed quite well in the immediate aftermath of that. And in the next 6 weeks over the holidays and throughout January to the end of January, when there was the next FOMC meeting, hardly anybody, if anybody at all, actually backed up Powell publicly. Now, I think given what we got at the most recent meeting for March, I think there is the possibility that we're going to get some people backing him up a little bit. So I thought, you know, in terms of kind of the takeaway, that was a big one. I thought that was extremely interesting. And there's a couple other little things too, like, you know, Powell did not seem to, kind of going back to where we started the conversation and you know, CPI and that sort of thing, seasonality, Powell seemed to dismiss at the press conference around the seasonal issue. He didn't seem to be overly concerned that it was going to be a, you know, that January and February were going to be permanent, that they were probably somewhat seasonal. And also this idea on the balance sheet, on the quantitative tightening story, right, he got a little more specific in terms of timing, saying the runoff could happen, quote, fairly soon. And that's also important because it matters a lot, particularly for fixed income markets. And, you know, could the quantitative tightening balance sheet program be tapered a little bit? And I think that's important. You know, the Fed's currently doing $95 billion a month.
Right.
Part of that is treasuries. Part of that is agencies. And, you know, could the Fed taper some of that? And that in theory would have an impact. And just for the math, for people that maybe don't follow this as closely. So quantitative easing, which I always find is easier, quantitative easing means you're buying, right? So you're buying bonds and you're adding it to the balance sheet. So price is higher, yields lower, trying to improve credit in the economy.
Right.
Quantitative tightening is the reverse. So you're either actively selling or letting bonds roll off your balance sheet as they expire. So price is lower, yields higher. In theory, you're tightening credit conditions in the market. So curtailing quantitative tightening means that you're not going to let things roll off as fast. So in a way, it's less tightening. I mean, you're still tightening. You're just tightening at a slower pace.
Makes a lot of sense, Dustin. Great commentary. Maybe I'll turn to Canada. It seems as though we're in the kind of opposite scenario than they were in the U.S., with inflation coming in a bit weaker than had been anticipated. The latest BOC meeting, they still projected the same amount of cuts. So what do you make out of the inflation number in Canada and the Bank of Canada reaction?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the last podcast we did was right after the Bank of Canada meeting.
Yeah.
And then since then, the last couple of weeks, we've had the Canadian CPI numbers as well. So to your point, they came in a little bit weaker than expected, and surprisingly so. People had expected the annual rate to go from 2.9 to 3.1, and it actually slowed to 2.8. Most of it, not all of it, but most of it was on the back of lower than expected, or at least not a big increase as expected in energy prices. They still increased, which is not at a level or at a pace that I think most people expected. And that's got people really thinking about Canada here in terms of the easing cycle. A lot of people have been penciling in June for the Fed, for Europe, continental Europe, for Bank of England, and for the Bank of Canada. And I think the CPI numbers most recently for February that came out this week seem to kind of underline the idea that the bank could ease rates in June. And just to talk about the calendar, the bank's meeting is a week before the Fed meeting. Fed's meeting in June. So, I mean, there's this, you know, is the bank going to go before the Fed? I mean, I think they're both going to go in June, but technically the bank's meeting is a week before. So, I mean, from a technicality perspective, I guess yes, although it's really not too far apart. I do think that, you know, the April meeting here for the bank obviously is extremely important. It's the last meeting before June. If they do indeed go in June, the April meeting will be a forecast meeting for the bank. So you get kind of the MPR, monetary policy report, the new forecast and that sort of thing. And I think that, I think there's a decent probability that the bank will tee it up for June at the April meeting. Inflation looks okay. It doesn't look amazing, but it looks okay. The issue and why I kind of hesitate when I say okay is because, you know, the bank here technically looks at headline inflation on an annual basis as its key metric, but core inflation is clearly not forgotten. And there are a lot of core inflation metrics that are flying around, and some look pretty constructive, some look less constructive. The ones that the bank has been focusing on since the pandemic, and actually since the middle of the pandemic, particularly trim core CPI and median core CPI, are still a little bit sticky and probably hanging up there a little bit more than the bank would like to see. But if you look at some of the other indices, particularly CPIX, which was the main core CPI index for the bank until the middle of the pandemic when it switched to those other two. CPIX, which basically takes out the eight most volatile components, is running, I believe, at 2.1 year over year, which is pretty, again, the bank targets headline, not core, but it's obviously 2.1% is kind of where you like to see things. And when you look at kind of regular old core CPI, as we know it from a textbook, you know, headline inflation less food and energy, it's also running at a pretty easy pace. And then when you look at headline CPI less shelter, and there's some discussion that some senior members of the bank prefer that measure, given the obvious reason that housing has been absolutely, right, you know, very, very expensive. It's also running at a decent clip. So that's why when I say inflation, particularly core, looks okay, I think it does. A number of Bank Canada watchers on macro types on the street are really pounding the table on, hey, the core metrics, the two core indices that you're looking at, banks looking at, are somewhat outdated and not really fully encapsulating or reflecting the state of play of where prices are at least on a core level in the country, and saying, actually, you guys are at risk of falling behind the curve and not easing fast enough, right, and maybe should have gone already type thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of those people would talk about maybe even April being a live meeting. I don't think it is. I wouldn't totally discount it, but I don't think it's massively live for the Bank of Canada. So I think that's kind of what's happening, but you kind of step back through all that detail and say, okay, like, you know, what's really going on here? I think the bank's getting closer to easing. Maybe that's an obvious statement, but I do think that, and I think this week's CPI data out of Canada, the February CPI data, really helps underscore that. I think the broad trend is in place. You can clearly have a spike higher in anything, really, March data or April data. But I think the broad data is there. And sitting here kind of mid to late March and looking at the June meeting, admittedly, it's early June. I think it's the 5th or the 6th. I think the bank can go. Now, where I think things get interesting here between kind of Canada and the Fed is, I think the Fed is on an every other meeting cadence in terms of easing for the year. So June, September, December for 24. I think the bank can outdove the Fed. And I'm not sure if they would go every meeting, but I think that the bank can go, you know, if you start at the June meeting, there's five meetings left for the year for both banks, to be fair, inclusive of June. And I think the bank could go four or five of those meetings, but I think the Fed does three. And that has obviously market implications, particularly for fixed income on a relative basis, you know, Canada, US, as well as obviously the currency in theory. And so we're spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, the probabilities around that, what's priced in, how we want to have the portfolio, in terms of trying to, you know, tactical alpha and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's really interesting. We spent a lot of time as market watchers looking at, very like smaller vol, particularly in FX, not necessarily in rates, but you've seen these central bank policies converge a little bit. And I think the starting point might still converge, but I think we're going to see a pickup in FX vol and maybe market vol across asset, not just fixed income, but elsewhere in the second half of the year as you see some of these policy divergence things happen. Like, for example, Switzerland eased rates overnight. It's the first of the G10 major economies to ease rates. And it didn't wait for the ECB at all. Never mind the Fed. That might not sound like much, but in these kind of circles and how people think, I think it's okay. You know, they went. And not that everyone needs to do the same thing. Everyone, you know, does one thing. Everyone, you know, when someone does something, everyone should follow. But I think for the Swiss to go, particularly having started at a whopping 175 basis points and cutting by 25, either starting at a very, very low nominal level, I would think that it gives on the margin anyone else like a peripheral, like a G4, 5, 6, 7 bank, like a Canada, a little bit more comfort and confidence to say, yeah, we don't need to wait for the Fed. We don't need to wait for the ECB. Right. We can kind of get going. It's already started.
Right. Makes a lot of sense. Speaking of outlying central banks, we've talked over the, well over a year, I think, about Bank of Japan and what they're doing there. They finally raise their interest rates. I think that is the last place that you would issue negative yielding debt. So I don't think you can find negative yielding debt out there anymore. What was your view on Bank of Japan and how did you react?
Yeah, for sure. It's funny. I mean, it'll be funny. I mean, maybe funny from an academic perspective, but the same week you got the Bank of Japan hiking for the first time in 17 years, and then you had the Swiss, you know, like 48 hours, 60 hours later, 2.5 days later, basically, you know, cutting rates as the first G10 central bank. It's you know, and they're both seen as kind of funding currencies because they're and funding, you know, policy rates because their nominal rates are so low.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. But the bank, you know, Bank of Japan did finally hike after, you know, many years. I mean, for many people, I'm sure they've never seen the bank hike before. 17 years, a long time for anybody. We had, you know, since October and November had been penciling in April as the hike. And then maybe three-ish weeks ago with the data and some of the commentary, it seemed to suggest that March was pretty live, and it became relatively apparent, I think, either last week or the week before last, that March was definitely more probable than not. I would say they did hike a little bit more than expected. The general view was they would hike by 10 basis points and take their policy rate from minus 10 to zero. What they ended up doing was hiking so that the policy rate would be in a range from zero to 10 plus 10 basis points. So it's a little bit more than I think people expected.
Right.
And so it's not quite how the Fed does it in terms of Fed funds range, but it has overtones like that. So That's how I would think about it. So a few other things that I think are interesting. The bank obviously has been on this yield curve control policy for a long time. They've now officially dumped it or are about to dump it, depending on when they put it into effect. They dumped the ETF buying program. They dumped their REIT, called the J-REIT, Japanese Real Estate Investment Trust, buying program. They effectively dumped their corporate bond buying program as well. So all those are gone, because those are all part of the, you know, easier credit kind of mentality in Japan. So it's not just the rate side. There's a whole bunch of, you know, alphabet soup acronyms that they had going that there are effectively done or about to be done. But the bond buying program, the JGB bond buying program, even though they said they're getting rid of yield curve control in name, it still continues from a bond buying, a JGB, Japanese government bond buying program. So, and they have said that they're not necessarily going to amend it too much for now. We'll see about that. But I think that's interesting. So they will be continuing to come in and buy bonds, and probably at least inside 10 years on the curve, I would say artificially suppress yields. So yields are trading at a lower level than they probably would otherwise if they were purely being, you know, price discovery from a market forces perspective. So I think that's all very important. The market did not react as a lot of people would have expected on the first Bank of Japan hike in 17 years, particularly a little bit more of a hike than people would have generally expected. And the reason for that, I think, is because of the forward guidance that was being given by Governor Udea. And he essentially said that, or at least the interpretation of what he said was that they would not be coming back maybe at all this year in terms of additional hikes. And I think a lot of people had expected another 25 basis point hike, right, between maybe September or October. So he kind of, at least the interpretation was that he kind of tapped the brakes on that type of forward guidance. And so you did not see yields, Japanese government bond yields, rise significantly on the back of the announcement. They actually fell a little bit. And the yen did not appreciate on the back of that announcement. It actually depreciated against most currencies, including the dollar, which is generally the big trade dollar yen. And so we're actually well above 150, 150 now in dollar yen, and there's talk of FX intervention. But that's why I think the market, at least Japanese assets, didn't necessarily, at least FICC, didn't perform as people would have expected. I think it's more around the forward guidance as opposed to the hike itself. So now we're having a debate, I think, in the market about are they really gone for the year? Like, nothing done? Are they going to come back late summer or in the fall with something? Like, what does the hiking cycle actually look like, if anything at all? You know, and what does it mean for JGBs, Japanese government bonds, as well as yen against, you know, dollar, Canada, or any other cross for that matter.
Great context, Dustin. You've sort of alluded to this a few times, both in your comments on Canada and just now in Bank of Japan. But what are you doing in the portfolios based on your views of the different central banks?
So I think there's a lot to chew on here. It's been a very kind of event and data rich few weeks, and I think there will be more as we move through Q2. Again, June, I think, is going to be a significant month, given kind of all that's been set up. I am thinking very strongly around the idea of the Bank of Canada and the ECB outdoving the Fed, kind of like I mentioned a few minutes ago. And of course, it depends on positioning and it depends on what's already in the price. But I mean, all of the things being equal, that might mean that Canadian and call it the German benchmark, European duration, outperforms the US here for a little bit. Again, it matters if everyone's already in that trade, then you don't necessarily have, you know, the incremental buyer to actually make that price action happen, and obviously where levels are. But, you know, if theoretically speaking, if that's true, then Canadian European duration should outperform the US. And when you look at what's priced, at least just from a strip perspective, like what's priced for the Fed funds strip and the Bank of Canada strip for the calendar 24, it's close enough, kind of in the 85, 88 neighborhood. I haven't looked since early this morning, but in that neck of the woods, they were relatively close that you know, if I'm right on Bank of Canada policy and Fed policy, and I could very well be wrong, and I've been wrong many times, but if that turns out to be correct, then there needs to be more of a gap between what's being priced for calendar 24, just to kind of put goalposts around it, for Canada or Bank Canada and the Fed. And that should mean that Canadian fixed income at on certain parts of the curve should outperform the US. Where I'm also thinking here is, and it's a theme that we were at, I think I was talking about this with one of the PMs yesterday, maybe 5 or 6 months ago, this idea that if the Fed is going to be easing rates with core PCE at 2.5, 2.6, something like that, i.e. not 2%, inflation is going to be a little bit frothier. In theory, the back end of the curve may not like that, and in the US and maybe elsewhere. And does that mean that on the margin, real yields should outperform nominal yields? Because you would expect real yields to, on the margin, outperform nominal yields in a higher inflationary environment, not only present day, but also the expectations of a higher inflationary environment persisting. And I think that's really interesting. So when it kind of comes to, as I call it, the big four, you've got obviously U.S. Treasuries and then TIPS, which are obviously the real return bonds for the U.S., and then Canada nominal bonds, regular cash curve, and then literally real return bonds, which is what they're called here, which is the real yield or real bonds for the Canadian side. Now, the Canadian real return bond market is quite small from a volume perspective. And so there is a bit of a, depending, but generally there's a bit of a liquidity premium with Canadian real return bonds. And depending how big, your trades are and your book is, getting in and out of those things, particularly getting out, can sometimes be challenging. So I know Canadian investors and institutional asset managers, I think, would probably like real return bonds here, Canadian real return bonds. But if you can't get out of it for whatever reason, you've got that liquidity risk or premium, that makes people concerned, right? And it's kind of like, it's not a great example, but it's kind of like emerging markets. If you're in something that's a little bit speculative or anything that's speculative, really any asset, it's relatively easy to get in, but if everyone's running for the same exit door at the same time, it's not great. So we manage that obviously very, very closely from our client, from a client perspective. But I do think, again, if Bank Canada outdoves the Fed and Canadian duration on a nominal basis is looking more attractive than US nominal duration, then can you say the same thing about RRBs, real return bonds, versus TIPS in Canada, right? As TIPS in the US, sorry, TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So that's something we're thinking about a fair bit. Obviously, duration is one of the most important, if not the most important thing for any fixed income portfolio. And sitting here in Canada, obviously getting the Canada and US duration calls correct are, a paramount in terms of, performing for our clients. So it's something I spend a fair bit of time on, as you can imagine. But I do think that now that the Fed looks a little bit more willing to not skip June and actually start the easing cycle in June, even if it isn't every other meeting cadence, this idea around risk being bid, global resentment being constructive, carry trades and carry as a thematic hanging around for longer, I think is quite constructive. So that's one of the reasons I think, dollar yen is higher, because there's still, 500 basis points between Fed policy and BOJ policy, more than that, actually. So really, how far lower can dollar yen go when you can pick up 520 basis points just being long US dollars versus yen, or, equities are bid, or credit spreads, both investment grade and high yield, plumbing, cyclical, tights versus, versus the benchmark, or, equities obviously printing new highs here. So and EM, I would also say, right, particularly the high yielding EM, which we've talked about a lot, in Brazil, Mexico, still yielding 6.5% or 7% from a real yield perspective, give or take. from a real yield perspective. And so if the Fed is easing rates and the dollar is a little bit offered, i.e. lower, that carry environment should continue, that risk on environment should continue, constructive global risk sentiment. And, those trades I think do well, unless there's a reason for them to not do well. So obviously, a lot of things can knock that off, right? Fed changing its mind, geopolitics, people are just too, but terrible earnings. Fed decides to change, or sorry, Treasury decides to change something like last August on the supply side. There's a whole bunch of things that can change that. But, carry is a very, very powerful tool in terms of making strong gains for investors. And, I always go back to what I learned when I was a lot younger in terms of thematics. And, what is the current thematic and what is the next thematic going to be, and when is it going to, not necessarily start, but when are people going to recognize it? And we've been in a bit of a carry thematic here for a while. And as long as that thematic continues, you can see a lot of these trades that have done quite well over the last month or two continuing for a bit, obviously always monitoring for the idiosyncratic risk.
Dustin, thanks so much for walking through those portfolio ideas. Really appreciate you spending the time and your view on the Bank of Canada, Japan, and the Fed, as we discussed it during the podcast. So appreciate it.
Very welcome. Thanks very much for having me on.
The content of this podcast, including facts, views, opinions, and recommendations, is not to be used or construed as investment advice and is not an offer or an invitation to buy or sell any security. The content of this podcast should not be relied upon for any purposes, and Mackenzie Financial Corporation is not responsible for any reliance upon it. This podcast includes forward-looking information that reflects our current expectations or forecasts of future events. Forward-looking information is subject to risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed herein. Our views are subject to change based on market conditions. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts and prospectus before investing. The indicated rates of returns are historical annual compounded total returns, including changes to unit values and reinvestment of all dividends or distributions, and does not take into account sales, redemptions, distribution, or optional charges or income taxes payable by any security holder that would have reduced returns.